This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run begins. It is the 22nd of August, and just after 6 o'clock. Brian, how are you feeling today?
Oh, good.
Okay, but you perhaps might take a little pause on the feel-good factor, because over the last, 12 hours or so, things have really kind of gone wrong in all places.
Unfortunately, yes, looking at the news.
So in Singapore, we had, of course, that crash between a U.S. naval vessel and a merchant navy ship. It's resulted in 10 sailors on that U.S. Naval vessel going missing. And I believe till now, we haven't had any updates on that. It also, interestingly, happened in a territory, or at least a watery territory, that is disputed by both Malaysia and Singapore. But in this instance, the forces from both sides are cooperating to help in the search and rescue mission. Also in the news overnight, we had reports that Spanish police have shot dead what they believe is the main suspect in last Thursday Barcelona attack. His name is Yunus Abu Yaqub. Very young man, and it's somewhat tragic, Brian, when you look at these stories to see how young many of these perpetrators are and how they've been sold a dream that's led to their own deaths. So quite sad there. Though in the Burkina Faso story, which happened just days before the Barcelona attack, we have really no updates on the perpetrators there.
No, and it's so surprising how easily young people can be radicalized and made to do stuff that you would normally never think. Some of them are from very normal middle class backgrounds.
Yeah, well, there you have it. Also, on a happier note, the U.S. public has witnessed its first coast-to-coast solar eclipse in the 100 years. So this was a swath, I believe, about 50 or 70 kilometers wide that crossed continental America. And it got so many people excited over the weekend. Though, I must say, talking about excitement, because we have currently locally the SEA Games. And apart from that spectacular opening ceremony, what we've had is a series of kerfuffles.
Comedy of errors, really. I would put it that way.
Yeah, and it's led to our neighbors being very unhappy. We'll come back to our unhappy neighbors shortly. But first, we have Tooth and Maytals and with their song Funky Kingston, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Brian Fernandez. And that was Toots and Maytals, that are the Toots and the Maytals, with Funky Kingston. Brian, we were talking earlier about this solar eclipse in the US. There's some stunning numbers coming out of it about not just productivity, losses that are going to be made during that. So there is the fact that estimates are that about $694 million are going to go missing from output for the roughly 20 minutes that this solar eclipse is going to present itself at different points in that line of that corridor across the continental U.S. But it also kind of notes that some 87 employees will be at work during the time of the eclipse. Now, doesn't seem like very much. According to the statisticians, this isn't very much in terms of the overall output of wage packet for American workers over the course of a year, and that this is not going to make its any kind of impression on the macroeconomic data. But the news of it itself incensed so many Americans that it's become the news, that the fact that there was this little item calculating loss of productivity. And one of the things that really angered them is that why are we so obsessed with the question of productivity?
So, Sharad, to me, it's just a hair-splitting exercise. 20 minutes of a productive day, for example, is a lot of time where people spend over the water cooler chatting, or in a Malaysian context, taking a break and going having a teh tarik. I think if you look at some of our organizations, people spend a lot more time taking a time of clocking into work and then clocking off and going downstairs and having a teh tarik.
That may be, but this, the thing is, it's going to happen in a spectacularly coordinated way, in which case the water cooler, decision to go to water cooler and chat over the water cooler is not coordinated across continental America. This is the other thing, because, Brian, that the outages, right? So you're going to have, a lot of cities or towns or buildings that supplied by solar energy are going to have a loss in the energy for a while. And
yes.
What's going to happen is the main grid is going to have to supply that energy. So this whole thing actually has amazing repercussions. But coming back to the question of why people are so irritated by this article, and there's quite a bit. I mean, literally thousands of people have weighed in on this, saying, you know, why do economists do this? Why do statisticians want to spoil a good thing? Why isn't it important for us to be aware of our place in the solar system, in the universe, from a scientific point of view, as opposed to constantly having our head buried in the productivity sandbox?
And that's a very good point. I think that awareness has, among the general population in terms of the love for science, I think has gone down quite dramatically, even though we live in such a technological society. So I still remember as a child, as a seven-year-old, for example, being quite interested in astronomy and looking up in the stars. And my first thing was actually a little binoculars. And then later on, I think I saved up
some money.
Which
you used to look at the neighbors, presumably.
Actually, silly enough, I tried to look up at the stars. I was not a peeping Tom.
Wrong instrument.
Wrong instrument. Later on, I managed to save up and bought myself a second-hand telescope. And I was about 7 or 8 years old at that time. And
Parents gave you a lot of pocket money.
No, because this is Christmas money, New Year money, all that sort of stuff, you know. And what happened was then, that also then ignited that further when the stars seemed just a lot closer. Very simple stuff. But I think that sort of element has sort of gone away from your young children right
okay,
now.
Okay, so you have a daughter who's, I believe, like under 10 or something.
Yes, she's 9 years old.
So she interested in the solar eclipse?
Actually, she has a telescope too. So and she asked for it.
Oh, so you bought her. So yeah. Your daddy didn't make her save up her money.
No. She actually got one from, I think, her grandparents or something like that.
Oh, I see. Okay. So the things, and that's the interesting angle too, right? That this, in fact, is one of those moments where people become, painfully aware of our place in the universe, which is, of course, of a great insignificance.
Yes,
what
absolutely.
Are we? We're just one little speck.
In
the universe. But and then maybe even endeavor to understand, how planet Earth came to be, how much we are, influenced by external events, so meteors and all those things that shaped the planet Earth. I think that's an interesting history that perhaps doesn't get taught enough in schools.
Yeah, and what happens is I have a different perspective. A solar eclipse.
From that of the scientific community.
No, just a simple perspective in terms of how an event like this acts as a catalyst with young children to pursue a greater interest in science, because they look at something like, say, wow, this thing happens in the middle of the day. Why? And then it sparks off then research. They would probably, a lot of people, young children would probably go to YouTube then and say, hey, which is their first port of call, or the internet and say, hey, why does this happen? Perhaps that serves as a catalyst to greater interest in science.
Okay. And after these messages, there's Bruce Hornsby and The Range with The Valley Road. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Bruce Hornsby and The Range with The Valley Road. A lyrical piece there. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. Now time to look at the question of media, social media, because it's all around us, and we're constantly talking about it and what it's doing in terms of our relationships. So we have a story here from Wired, which is about the question of material that you should or should not place on the social media. And many times that we watch videos that go viral, they have to do with people. Sometimes they have to do with rats, for instance, or other kinds of vermin. And we have that case of the cafeteria in Klang. But also, Brian, we've had these situations where when people go ballistic, or we had road rage, or we've had people acting badly, it's captured on video. And that video gets onto social media and we share, we like to comment on things, But often we don't pause to think whether what we've done in terms of posting these things and making them public, whether it's actually done good for the world or the society in which we live in, or it's actually just won the person who did the posting a lot of likes and thumbs up. I mean, what really, on balance, is the real purpose for us to put that kind of material out there in the world?
Now, so I've got to come from my perspective where I've actually never put something like that on social media. I tend to be quite guarded in terms of what I actually post. Now, however, I like it when people post stuff that shaming other individuals.
You like the shaming?
I actually like it. So, because the thing is, what's happened in our society
is this. I can see you in a mob holding a stone and lobbing it.
And casting this first stone, right? No, but actually what it's all about is this. I think we need to modify poor behavior. A lot of people think that they can get away with stuff, and it's only after it's captured on social and distributed via social media that they actually modify their behavior.
Okay, so you have recent evidence for the position you take, which is that case of the three Malaysian undergraduates in Osaka who trashed a little inn or Airbnb.
That's right.
And of course, the fact that it had gone viral, and also maybe the fact that the owners, the Italian owners of that Osaka inn, actually made a police report, that they have now, or at least one of them has come out to apologize. But does it really change people's behavior? Yes, they might be shamed. Yes, they might make an apology just because that takes the heat off them. But does it actually change people?
Now, I'll take the different approach and say, what happens if you don't share it? That bad behavior then continues.
No, well, let's just take the scenario where in that instance the video wasn't shared, right? You would have had the owner take those three young men to a police station, or at least they made a police report, because it's a different country, so it's a slightly different jurisdiction, and there are practical issues around that. It could have been resolved, as it was done before the advent of social media platforms. It would have been resolved among the stakeholders, the three men, the owner of the inn, the manager of the inn and such, right? So it's not like the world did not have, things did not happen in the real world before the advent of social media.
But here's the thing, Sharad. Previously, in this case, for example, and let's use the Osaka incident, the guys left the country already. So there would have been no resolution to this matter beyond the owner making the police report.
Yeah. So potentially that's true. So in this, you have just because they cross jurisdictions, right? But in a situation where it's a Malaysian-based incident and all the actors are, in fact, in Malaysia, why couldn't you have a resolution that's quiet, invisible to the larger public?
But that's theoretical. But did it really happen in the past? A lot of times these things just swept under the carpet, people just moved on.
Yeah, that's very possible as well. But what is also equally possible is that the resolutions that you have are there manufactured to be yet part of the spectacle, right? So you have the apology, and it's a public apology, but do we have a change of heart? Do we have, and more importantly, and I think this is to add to your point, which is that other people will not mimic this behavior.
Exactly.
Though I do see the potential of people, because fame trumps everything else in this world of social media, that people will act badly precisely because they want the attention.
But true to some extent, but I think in general what we're seeing is behavior modifications. People look at that and say, hey, that's unacceptable.
Well,
if I do this, I'm going to be shamed. So therefore, I don't do this.
And of course, what you've seen since the advent of Facebook is a beautiful world where people don't do bad things, right, Brian? Yes. Well, as far as I know, bad behavior continues. They're coming up. Tim Buckley and Honeyman, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Depeche Mode with Just Can't Get Enough. I'm sure I couldn't with me, Brian Fernandez. And of course, some people can't get, not just, they had more than enough of Malaysians. They've had their fill of Malaysians. You know, if you remember that story, Brian, of the three Malaysian students who misbehaved at a guest house in Osaka. Well, one of those students, just to update everybody, one of those students has apologized. But the homestay has now banned Malaysians in general from staying there. And the owner claims that this is the third time that he's been hit by badly behaving Malaysians. Also banned are Koreans and Chinese tourists. We're in excellent company, by the way. Yeah. We spoke to Karina Byron. She's the owner of La Pari Pari Resort in Langkawi. And we asked her about her worst experience when dealing with Malaysian guests.
Lots, unfortunately. We've had, don't get me wrong, we get really good Malaysian guests, or we get really good guests most of the time from all over the world, but the ones who are, you know, who have misbehaved in the past have generally been people who just simply refuse to, you know, adhere to the rules on the property. Swimming in the pool when they're not supposed to, getting into fights with each other and us having to call the police. And there's been one time when we'd had to evict people, or getting very drunk in the restaurant, you know, in front of their children, and then becoming very abusive towards other customers, things like that.
That was Karina Byron, owner of La Pari Pari Resort in Langkawi. Bran, we also spoke to Kim Sen. She's an Airbnb host in Sydney who hosted three Malaysian parties. And we asked about and if she had any bad experiences with Malaysians.
So the first Malaysian party that I hosted was quite negative. I'm new to Airbnb hosting, and that was my first negative experience. So it was quite shocking for me. From the first day that they checked in, the party of four ladies were very demanding. I felt that she expected a hotel treatment. So she was asking my daughter whether she was the one that would be cooking them breakfast every morning. And my daughter was a little bit shocked with that. They also asked when they found out. So my listing, I've actually listed that we live on the property. And even though I had it on my listing that we live on the property, they were quite surprised that we live there. And they wanted to see our private rooms upstairs, you know, to see the whole house. And to that, we sort of declined. And when they arrived, they also realised that your Malaysian plugs aren't the same as the Australian PowerPoint, so none of their chargers worked. And I provided them with a phone charger. And when they checked out, I asked them to leave the key on the kitchen bench along with my charger, and they took my charger. They didn't return it.
That was Kim Sen, an Airbnb host in Sydney, speaking about the Malaysians that she's had on her property. Now, Brian, just on the last one, I get the whole thing about not obeying rules and fighting and abuse. But with this Australian example, it's somewhat more benign. It seems like, okay, like when those guests said they wanted to see the other rooms, it was more like Malaysians being nosy in a kind of very Malaysian way.
Yes.
And maybe this grates or seen as a massive or major act of intrusiveness on the part of, you know, say an Australian whose sense of personal space might be quite different from a Malaysian.
Yes, exactly. I agree with you on that. It's probably more to do with that's our different senses of personal space. You know, Malaysians are kepo, so we want to go and look at all this stuff. Australians tend to be more private. For example, you would never call an Australian unless you knew them very well, and they're always away. After 9 o'clock, that's an unwritten rule. You just don't call them on the phone.
9 o'clock in the morning or 9 o'clock in the evening?
In the evening. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, that part I agree with you, but I'm quite embarrassed, actually, what the earlier...
This is the thing, right? So do you feel... You clearly feel this kind of collective embarrassment?
Yes,
as
I do.
You do, huh?
The ugly Malaysian traveller.
Why didn't you just put it down to bad individuals? After all, every community has its bad hats or people who are negligent or rude or stupid or whatever. Why would you think this, you know, reflects badly on Malaysians?
Well, how many times have you heard about badly behaved Japanese tourists, for example?
Well, I haven't, but then I don't really talk about tourists. But then, okay, I think for me, the issue would be if I went somewhere and I was declined a room because they said, well, I'm sorry, we don't serve Malaysians. I mean, that would upset me because then I could see it having a kind of an effect on me personally. But I just... maybe part of me doesn't buy into this kind of national character type of discussion. So it doesn't matter to me that people say, I say, well, that's just, you know, stereotyping. If you want to stereotype Malaysians, that's your fault.
So here's the thing. From the time I was in university, and that was the first time I traveled abroad, I developed the Malaysian consciousness of myself. So I always, whenever I'm abroad, look at myself as an ambassador for Malaysia. God. Seriously,
well, that seems it sounds so
cliche.
Yes,
so I try to make sure I'm well behaved.
You, the Malaysian, Brian Fernandez, Malaysian ambassador, will now go to the pub and watch a football game.
Behave myself and not be allowed.
It's an unnecessary burden that people put on themselves. I mean, it's good if it leads to good behavior and being polite. But if you were your own ambassador, wouldn't that be sufficient? I mean, being a good person, wouldn't that be sufficient?
Yeah, of course. But it's by extension, you will be also identified by your nationality when you are traveling.
Fascinating stuff. Manfred Mann, I put a spell on you after these messages. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm sure. I'd continue with me, Brian Fernandez. And that was Manfred Mann with I Put a Spell on You. Of course, if you type into the search space on YouTube, you probably find an Annie Lennox version of that song. But you might not find, and this because it's the all-time classic version by Nina Simone. So I would check out Nina Simone.
Nina Simone.
Right, I Put a Spell on You. A beautiful, beautiful song on this Tuesday morning. It's coming up to 53 minutes past six. It's the 22nd of August. Time to talk about the SEA Games because so much is happening. I mean, not just in the medal tallies, not just on the pitch, as it were, on the fields or in the arenas, but it's also happening outside. Some of it not very good, including a recent bus carrying squash players involved in an accident. Now, the bus driver has been arrested. Apparently, he has no driving license, but more importantly is how do our neighbors think of us when they send athletes who've been training for months, perhaps years, for this game, and then on the way to the games they get injured or traumatized in a bus crash? I mean, can they be then performing at the top of their game? And, you know, it's kind of the unfair advantage that puts all the other athletes because a team has now been, through no fault of their own, injured by negligence on the part of the organizers.
And it is, as a former athlete, I can tell you that it really, any small
you're
thing.
You're a former SEA Games athlete? Did
not
you
a SEA Games athlete. At a schoolboy level, I was at a national level. And it's very difficult to perform when you have the slightest changes to your routine. If you've planned, for example, for a certain meal that you normally have just before competition and you don't have that meal, that affects you tremendously. If there's any disturbance in terms of you don't have the right socks even, so sometimes that affects your performance. So something like this is a huge disruption to your performance.
Yeah, I can't imagine how bad that would be. So, you know, the real issue, I guess, for Malaysians is that when we don't create conditions that are conducive for our neighbours and our neighbours get angry, are they justified in that? You know, and I think that's one of the things that that now really kind of, I think, is going to be a weight on the shoulders of the organisers, because as much as they've apologised for their flag incident, they've actually not quelled, I think, sentiment and tempers. Now, we'll just look across the straits to Indonesia, and Andreas Hasono, who's an investigative journalist who also works for Human Rights Watch Malaysia, we reached out to him to try and understand... that's for later. I just want to very quickly come back to this discussion of the hackers, I got that a little confused there. The hackers in Indonesia who've hit out at Malaysia and Malaysian websites, some 30 of them were defaced by Indonesian hackers in an act of... Well, they're enraged. In fact, they had a hashtag that was trending. It says, shame on you, Malaysia.
Well, here's the thing. We cannot condone this sort of behaviour. This is unacceptable. But again, this stems from the fact also, I think, that underlying discomfort that both countries seem to have with each other, I think, it goes far back in terms of how we've treated Indonesia in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. They're not crazy for us, but this is Prince, Crazy For You, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and the Morning Run continues. It's coming up to 7 minutes past seven. It's the 22nd of August, and we have a great lineup for you for the rest of the day. We started at 6, and we're going to end at 10 a.m. Now, we've been talking about the SEA Games because it's full of not just happy moments, but some sort of controversial ones as well. And in our discussions, we had some responses on Twitter. Ku Kok Peng, who I believe is an associate with Pemandu, he says, and I quote him, "We made a mistake, we quickly apologized, and it was accepted. Time to move on. Remember, we too have been wronged in other games." Now, it's very interesting, Brian, that he should mention that the last part. It's not just something about moving on, because clearly he's not moving on in that last sentence. He's making yes. reference to past history when we were wronged. And, okay, so this is an interesting part and dimension of the SEA Games. It's all about regional unity.
That's the original intention of the SEAP Games. That's what it was all founded about.
Yes, but it's also based on national rivalries. So you have these two competing dynamics set up in the Games. One, you know, the hoopla of regional unity. On the other hand,
the reality hugging and kissing each other. Rivalry.
So we spoke to Andres Hassono, who is an investigative journalist and also works with Human Rights Watch. He's based in Jakarta. And we're talking about this backlash, right? So we had the apology. Malaysia said they're going to reprint the booklets. They're going to do right by the Indonesians. We also did wrong by the Bruneians, by the way. But there's still unhappiness. We talked about the hackers and the many websites that were defaced yesterday. When we talked to Andreas Hassono, we asked him, you know, how he would have responded to such an error getting us to understand the sentiments that Indonesians have at this point in time.
I am quite familiar with writing things. I am familiar with copy editing problem. So I personally just see it as a copy editing error. Of course, it is embarrassing for the Malaysian government, but you know, nothing else. It is just a copy editing matter. But, you know, this is social media era. It is being enhanced on social media. People raise their anger, and there is a Twitter handle, "Shame on you, Malaysia," which is becoming viral. People are just angry, but I don't think it is going to be serious.
Now, we also asked Andreas if this apology is viewed as adequate.
I think so. Both ministers have a meeting in KL. The Malaysian minister apologized sincerely, genuinely. They also promised that they will pull out the remaining booklet, printing new ones, to be distributed among the SEA Games, Southeast Asian Games participants. I think that is adequate. What else? What can you do? The mistake has already been done. The error has already been done. Just say sorry. Nothing else. This is just quarrel among siblings. We are all Southeast Asian nation. It is normal, just quarrel among siblings. Nobody is killed, you know, no territory is taken, no blood. I think this is just emotional, just high temper. That's all, you know. Next week, we are going to be okay.
That was Andreas Hassono, the veteran Indonesian journalist. Very generous on his part. Also, you know, reflecting or echoing that sentiment from his president, Joko Widodo, who also said it's a small matter, let's move on, though he said an apology would be welcome. Now, because there are other things that happen beyond the question of a misprint in a booklet that has to do with the perception of whether refereeing is fair or whether the host country has, you know, home ground advantage. All these things do niggle and sort of irritate athletes, doesn't it?
Yes, and Sharad, this has been a perennial problem with the SEA Games, with parochial crowds, with biased refereeing. I think we, as Malaysians, have been a victim of that in previous SEA Games as well. Nothing new. So it never surprised me that you know, these things happen, especially with the Sepak Takraw and the team walking out. That actually didn't surprise me as much because when you have line calls, which can be quite subjective, especially if it's on the line, close call, and it goes against you as an athlete, it really upsets you.
Now, Kok Ping has responded again. He says he has, in fact, moved on. He was just highlighting that, and I quote him, we have similar experiences in the past, and we have gone past that. No point stirring hatred. And he's absolutely right. I mean, there is no point in stirring hatred, but the traditional rivalries that we have, say, with a Singapore or with an Indonesia is actually quite deep. And you remember, we've had that kerfuffle over some cultural dance that we claim was ours and they said was theirs. And, you know, there's all
same
this
thing with food as well.
Absolutely. So who claims to be the home of the authentic, original point of the development of certain traditions, whether it's culinary or otherwise? All this, of course, comes back to the dual nature of games, right? And that they're both meeting points for different communities and, you know, identities to come, but they also set up rivalry and conflict. But I guess the important thing to remember about sports is that it's also rule governed, right? So you're not rioting on the streets. I mean, you're taking out your anger, but you're doing it within the confines of the
anger. Hopefully, it's rivalry.
Yeah, and rivalry has. I mean, of course, and if we've lost, you might feel deeply anguished by it, especially if you feel wrong. Now, and come back to that bus crash, which I think is in fact much more serious as a failure on our part and the part of the organization. Now, when athletes are actually injured and cannot perform, now you have a real problem.
Because there's a negligence issue as well, because the driver didn't have a driving license.
Yeah, so how is it that somebody without a driving license was recruited to work on a project as important and as sensitive as this? And I think, you know, we will probably have a post-mortem on this. And, you know, and sports journalists and others will be looking at the games as they after they close. They're closing, of course, on the 30th of this month.
Yeah, and it's a little bit surprising because we've organized lots of big events before. We've organized things like the Commonwealth Games many years ago successfully. And that was in 1998. There's so many learnings. What I can't understand is why are we making basic mistakes like this
also,
at this day and age?
Yeah, you know, there's also this other thing, you know, about wanting to or aspiring to host major games. And of course, we've seen in many other countries, you know, organizations fail. But the one big story, I think, over the last year or so has how we treat athletes from countries that we don't recognize. I'm thinking primarily of Israel here. And because in many ways we count ourselves out of the running for hosting international events when we can't deal with, say, the Israeli team, not allow them to either have their flag or their national emblems and symbols because we don't recognize that country. And I think it's a real problem. I think it's a conundrum for the country and people involved in sports about how we want to go forward on that question when it comes to hosting events. Well, we'll be back with more news and analysis after this. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.